appropriate. The judge may accept that plea, but in doing so, we'll have to indicate on the record the reasons for accepting the plea and the reasons for accepting the departure sentence or imposing departure sentence.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Is this depart, you can depart up or down, is that right?
Senator Hill, that is correct.
You have reasons for each way.
Moving to sections 3, 4, and 5, these have to do with the accusatory instrument. Section 3 is merely a codification instruction. Section 4 indicates that in filing the accusatory instruments, the district attorney shall allege those facts sufficient to classify the offense on the crime seriousness scale. In most cases, this will not involve any new information. The district attorney will allege those facts for which there is an offense violation alleged. In the case where there is a subcategory offense, say, for example, burglary, which has three subcategories, the district attorney under this provision would be required to indicate what subcategory and what factor would place that offender in the appropriate subcategory. In Section 5, this amends a current statutory provision, ORS 135.815. This requires that a summary of the defendant's criminal record would be part of the information that the state is required to provide to the defendant. Because criminal history will now play a more important role in the sentencing decision, it was determined that this information should be provided to the defendant to allow him or her to make that part of his case when the sentencing comes, if it comes to that. Section 6, we now enter into the
provision. Excuse me, can I stop you, Bob? Is there a time frame on that? We had some debate about when. Is that going to be in another part, or we decided not to deal with that? Like when that criminal history comes to the defendant's?
Madam Chair, that will come in another part as well.
Okay.
This is the initial this is the initial information that the state will provide the offender, but we will get to the,
okay,
the other
excuse
information
me
as well. Section 6 begins the specific sections in which we amend the current sentencing statutes to be consistent with sentencing guidelines. In Section 6, we amend ORS 137.010 to accomplish four primary objectives. First, and most importantly, it applies sentencing guidelines to those offenders who have been sentenced for offenses committed on or after September 1, 1989. This is consistent with the enabling legislation. If in certain situations it is not ascertained when this precise date of the conviction occurs, there's a provision in subsection 2 that clarifies that if there is no way of determining in that date, then the guidelines will not apply. So the prior indeterminate sentencing system will apply to any offenders for whom it's not clear when the crime of conviction took place. It's the language is clear that this will only apply when it's not clear that it occurred before September 1, 1989. So if we have an offense sometime in 1991 and nobody knows that whether it was May or June of 1991, that they will still be under the sentencing guideline system. The next objective of this section or these amendments is to eliminate the use of suspended sentences as an option. We do, as you will recall, include probationary sentences as an option under the guidelines, and in some cases, or in many cases, the presumptive sentence will be a probationary sentence. The judge will impose that sentence rather than impose a prison term and suspend that sentence, as is now the current practice for probation. This is consistent with other guideline systems which make that distinction. The fourth, and this occurs in subsection 8, it merely indicates that for every prison term imposed, there will also be imposed a term of post-prison supervision. Unlike other sentencing guideline systems, we have incorporated a definite supervisory period, and that will be set by the sentencing judge. And this subsection 8 has now been amended to permit that, or in fact to require it. In addition to that, the sentencing judge, when imposing the sentence up front, will also inform the defendant that he or she will be not only sentenced to post-prison supervision as part of the sentence, but is also subject to sanctions for violations of that supervision. So the offender is put on notice at the sentencing hearing that he or she will be liable for some penitentiary time if he or she fails to meet the conditions of
I want to stop you. This is a, none of the other states who have embarked on sentencing guidelines include within their sentencing guidelines a post-incarceration supervision time period. Is that correct?
In Minnesota, excuse me, Madam Chair, in Minnesota they did, but they did it in the context of good time and any sentence reductions that are associated with good times. It became for them an administrative process. They were released early, they went out to a supervisory status, and then the Department of Corrections controlled whether they would be returned. In Washington, they did not have any post-prison supervision at all. They, as soon as you served your time, including good time reductions, you were cut loose. They've retracted on that policy, and they are now implementing a new supervision period. Moving on to Section 7, this directs the Sentencing Guidelines Board to develop rules to set the minimum information that will be included in pre-sentence reports and to create a sentencing report form. As you will recall, one of the very important aspects of guidelines is to be able to monitor sentencing practices to get better data on what is occurring at the court level. This will allow that to take place. It will also try to minimize the impact that the guidelines will have on pre-sentence investigative writers, whereby for most cases the minimal information will be only that which is necessary to classify the offender on the crime seriousness scale and a summary of the offender's criminal history record. It still, however, does provide that if the sentencing court, the defendant, or the district attorney requests a full-blown PSI, that still will be permitted under these rules. I should also note that we have included, we have been careful to retain the opportunity to allow the victim to make statements to the PSI writer to be included in the report to the sentencing judge. That will be available in every case. Section 8 amends ORS 137.079. This also is geared to informing the victim. This makes pre-sentence reports available to crime victims. It also is an important section in that it provides that the criminal history summary that's included in the PSI will serve as prima facie evidence of the defendant's criminal history. In other words, if the defendant remains silent or agrees to the criminal history summary, that will be the summary or the record that the court will use to classify the offender on the criminal history grid. If the defendant, however, raises objections to the content of that summary, the state would then have the burden of proof at a standard of a preponderance of the evidence to prove the exact nature of the offender's criminal history. The subsection 4 is a provision that says that no issue of related to the criminal history can be appealed except as a matter of an appellate court appeal, except as provided by Section 21. Section 21 is our appellate review provision, and I will address the criminal history aspect later in reviewing that section. Section 9 amends ORS 137.080. This indicates that the consideration of aggravating and mitigating factors will be permissive under the guideline system, but that consideration of those factors should be in accordance with the sentencing guidelines rules. Section 10 amends ORS 137.090. to allow the sentencing court to consider any trustworthy or reliable evidence in assessing what is aggravating and mitigating factors. Such evidence may be any evidence which is taken during any portion of the prosecution against the offender, and any information included in the pre-sentence report, including any statements from the victim. Section 11 amends ORS 137.120. This is once again is a clarification, is a statement that for offenders committed, convicted of crimes committed on or after September 1, 1989, they will be sentenced under the guideline system.
Okay, I'm going to say to committee members, if you have questions along the way, wave your hand or interrupt something, because we're moving quickly through these words. Make sure that we have an opportunity to stop Bob if we're not clear of what he's saying. Go ahead, Bob.
Section 12 amends ORS 137.122. ORS 137.122 and ORS 137.123 has to do with how, when the determination is made as to whether the sentence should be imposed concurrently or consecutively, and what are the requirements. Currently, the provision requires that the crimes be more than incidental violations of the same offense or of separate statutory provisions, or represent distinct harms. The proposal from the Sentencing Guidelines Council is that both of these findings be made in each case. What this will allow is that offenders, I don't believe this will change when consecutive sentences will be imposed. It merely is more consistent with the just deserts policy which we've developed in the guideline systems. So you not only need to show that it is a separate criminal act, but that it did create a new harm. And once again, the nature of that harm is important under our just desert systems as it's been incorporated in the guideline system. The Section 13 amends ORS 137.123, both 137.122 and 123 are very similar in their structure, and we've made parallel amendments to both of those sections. Section 14 provides that the maximum sentence for consecutive sentences shall be consistent with the rules of the Sentencing Guidelines Board. As you will recall, we do have new provisions in the guidelines rules for how consecutive sentences will be calculated. This provision makes sure that under the sentencing systems, under the statutory provisions, that those rules will be complied with. Section 15 amends ORS 137.520 to eliminate the reference to suspended sentences. Once again, as I noted earlier, a suspended sentence will not be used under the new guideline system. Section 16, ORS 137.540, is amended to provide that all custodial conditions of probation will be imposed consistent with the rules of the guidelines. Once again, under current law, the judge has a fairly broad discretion in what kind of conditions of probation may be imposed. And as you will recall, the sentencing guidelines does structure to some degree what kind of custodial sanctions can be imposed. This provision merely clarifies that the guidelines will be applied in such circumstances. Section 17, ORS 137.550, accomplishes three objectives. First, it requires the judge to follow the guidelines when modifying probationary terms for crimes committed on or after September 1, 1989. So for those offenders who are under the guidelines, the judge will have to perceive the rules of the guidelines board in determining what kind of modifications may be appropriate. The rules do not change to any great degree the authority of the judge to modify probationary terms. It also applies the rules of the guidelines to revocation sanctions to all offenders, regardless of the date which crime of conviction was committed. What is intended here is that all offenders on probation, either under the current system or under the prior, under the current indeterminate sentencing system or under the guidelines, after the effective date of this statute if they are revoked, the sentencing judge should use the sanctions that the that are included in the guidelines in sentencing that offender to a prison term.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Is that the portion that we talked about that an attorney general's opinion has been requested?
Counsel, I'm going to have to ask Kathleen for that. That is part of it. We also did have a number of issues related to parole as well.
Do we have any idea when that AG opinion is going to be ready? Thank you.
The third objective that the amendments to 137.550 will accomplish is it authorizes, rather than requires, the sentencing judge to grant credit against imprisonment sanctions for jail time served as a condition of probation. The structure that is now in place is that if the judge imposes a 6 months jail term as a condition of probation, he or she may, subsequently to revoking that offender under this provision, is now required to give that offender credit for 6 months if he revokes that offender to a prison sentence. So this provision makes that optional. And the reason for that is under the guideline system, the judge will be restricted into what kind of sanctions may be imposed as conditions of probation. This will not use that against the sanction that is also included in the guidelines for violations of probation. Section 18 is a new provision. This requires that when a probationary sentence includes a condition, a custodial condition of probation, that's jail or any kind of home arrest, restitution center sanction, the sentencing judge shall sentence the offender to the custody of the supervisory authority with jurisdiction over the relevant custodial facility. This is a parallel provision that's currently in the rules themselves. It's just to make clear that this is the same process that the judges do use when imposing probationary sentences. It also requires that a record of the custody unit served be maintained by the supervisory authority. If you will recall, we do include in the guideline system this concept of custody units, subsection 3 of section 18. Just clarifies that for these offenders under the guideline system that the supervisory authority will be keeping track of how much time the offender actually serves. And when there is a requirement that there be a successful completion of a program, the supervisory authority will also be responsible for saying, yes, this offender did, in fact, successfully complete the program. Section 19 is also a new section. It directs the sentencing court to ensure that fingerprints are taken for all offenders who have been convicted of a Class A misdemeanor or a felony to be collected at the time of conviction. For many of these offenders, they will have already been printed, but this is a provision that will require that the sentencing court make sure that it's been done upon conviction.
Madam Chair.
Senator Springer.
I'm a little, having seen these kinds of issues when we direct the court or the DA or even the cops to do something like this, first thing they scream about is the cost. And what's the feedback so far? I mean, this is the kind of seems pretty little, but could cause a lot of folks to trip pretty hard.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, what this provision does is actually replace another provision that is repealed later in this bill, which now requires that the judge make sure that those fingerprints are taken at the time of arraignment. So by putting it off to conviction, first of all, the number of offenders who need to be printed will be smaller. As far as my own knowledge of feedback is that there isn't any opposition that I know of to this, although I don't know to what degree that they're now doing it at the time of arraignment.
Do you have just briefly, I'm sorry to digress, but...
No, that's all right. This has been a matter, a subject of major debate along the way anyway, so we need to flag it now.
You know, when you're talking about the huge volume some of our courts have in traffic crimes, which are A misdemeanors, what's your sense of the current compliance rate? My sense is, and I hope I'm wrong, it's not 100%, it's not anywhere near 100%.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, once again, if I could defer to Kathleen, I think she probably could give us a better answer.
You want to come on up and get your name on the record if you agree?
Not that I disagree with the policy, I'm just trying to think of the ramifications.
I'm Kathleen Bogan, I'm the Director of the Council. This language has not been uncontroversial, and I think when you have public testimony, you'll hear from the DAs about some concerns they have, and I would expect that we'd hear from the courts. As Bob pointed out, the current law does say that at time of arrest, people are to be fingerprinted for felonies and sex and drug misdemeanors. Even that is not anywhere near 100% compliance, and I'm sure it's not even anywhere near 90% compliance. The council brought in an amendment in the last session to switch that to arraignment. At the time of arraignment, the court would inquire whether the fingerprints had been taken. And we have not followed up to find out if that increased the rate at all. This section was an attempt to compromise and to say, okay, since we have not yet been able to get a handle on fingerprinting these cases at arrest or at arraignment, the number of convictions would be smaller than either of those numbers. And so let's ask for it, not that arrests aren't important to track, because I think they are, but for purposes of felony sentencing guidelines and calculating people's criminal histories, we're really only interested in convictions. So we believe this was a compromise that the number for convictions would be smaller and therefore fewer prints to be taken. And my understanding from talking with some DAs on the phone was that they hadn't thought about that, and they're going to go back to the association and talk about what their position would be on it. Right now, in specific answer to your question, Senator Springer, the courts probably are not fingerprinting traffic offenses at all.
Okay.
Thank you. It's a...
I'm sure I wasn't the first to...
dialogue that we have huge amounts of millions of dollars being poured into the criminal justice system. We are here debating whether, in fact, we're reduced to the fact of whether somebody who gets convicted ought to have a fingerprint or not. And that's really where some of the crux of our problems lie, in fact. But that's my editorial, and we'll talk about that some more when the crew comes.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Anybody else? I think this is one of the more controversial things that people are fussing about with respect to the whole thing. Just astounding to me. But anyway, there we are.
We'll get them together with the folks who want to fingerprint our juveniles.
Right. That's going up tomorrow night, I think. Section 20. Unless you want to comment any more about fingerprinting, I think it's just our own informal diversion up here. Who's going next on Section 20?
I'll chime right in. Section 20, this is probably the most important aspect of this bill, and this provides for the appellate review sections. As we discussed a little in our earlier presentations, guidelines, the success of guidelines in structuring sentencing in a state hinge very significantly upon what kind of appellate review is going to be provided. Sections 20 and 21 is the council's effort to put into statutory form for your review the degree of appellate review that will be provided for guidelines decisions under this guideline system.
If I could interject, Madam Chair and members, before Bob reviews the provisions. These provisions, and while we don't
Hardy,
intend...
Hardy, you do need to give your name again. So
I'm sorry, Hardy Myers. While we don't intend to keep cross-referencing to the amendments you have throughout, I thought it would be helpful if we did that with respect to this section, so you could see how the final proposed provisions are. What I was going to say was, with those amendments also, I think it's accurate to say that these provisions, as they now stand, have been reviewed, participated in, and are, I believe, satisfactory to Chief Judge Joseph. Hope that's an accurate statement. I think he
it
has.
Was the last time I saw him on the bus. Usually if something doesn't, if he's not happy, I hear about it.
If they're not, I think it's because, unless he's had a change of mind, I think if there's still a problem, it's maybe because we've somehow failed to correctly capture the discussions that have occurred. But in any event, I wanted that to be before the committee as we started. This is not a provision that's now being presented to you with Judge Joseph waiting outside the door with his hatchet.
And those amendments are this is it then, or you have additional amendments that we have?
They're on the proposed amendments
and those
sheet
are in your file.
If you have
we have
those,
them in the
yes.
file, okay. And are you going to be talking
they're going
to
be
the
a
amendments?
I thought I would have Bob cross-reference those
good.
As he went through this section.
Okay, we need to get them out, folks.
They're about they're almost the first amendments, so they're going to appear right at near the top of page one.
They're dated 3/28/89.
Okay, thanks.
Section 20 is a provision that will reduce the number of appeals that do go to the Court of Appeals. What Section 20 does is creates a mechanism which will allow the sentencing court to retain jurisdiction in the case to consider any claims of error due to arithmetic or clerical errors. We understand from the experience in Minnesota and to some degree in Washington that initially there will be some difficulties with people learning how to use the system, which will result in fairly simple errors, addition errors. Classification errors that don't need a lot of consideration by the appellate courts. For these offenders, in these circumstances, the court will be allowed for 30 days after sentencing to make corrections, to impose the proper sentence under the guidelines after being notified of the error. Section 21 provides the substantive provisions of our appellate court review of sentencing guidelines. Subsection 1 indicates right off what kind of sentences under this sentencing system that will not be reviewed by the appellate courts. First is any sentence that is a presumptive sentence under the guidelines, except for as provided by subsection 3, and we'll get to subsection 3 in a moment. Any sentence that is either an optional probationary sentence under those three grid blocks, if you will recall, three grid blocks in the grid provide that for certain offenders that they may have a presumptive, although they have a presumptive prison term, the sentencing court under certain circumstances can impose a probationary sentence. If the court imposes either a prison term or a probationary sentence for those offenders, there will not be an appeal of the sentence. The third type of sentence that will not be subject to appeal is any sentence that results from a plea agreement. As you'll recall, nearly 95% or more of our cases are now resolved by plea agreement. For those cases, under the guideline systems, the sentences in those cases will not be subject to appeal in our appellate courts. Finally, a larger category, any other issue that is not described in Section 2 and 3, subsections 2 and 3 indicate what are, in fact, issues to be appealed under the guidelines. Subsection 1 indicates that any departure sentence, a sentence that does not comply with the requirements of the guideline system, may be a proper issue for appellate review. But when that issue is raised, the appellate court's scope of review will be limited to determining whether the facts that were given for the departure, one, are supported by substantial evidence in the record, and two, whether those reasons constitute a substantial reason for departure. It's important here to note that under the current rules, the standard for departures is a substantial and compelling reasons. We received testimony from Judge Joseph that many of his colleagues felt the two words "and compelling" were somewhat redundant and did not add substantially to the term "substantial," and for that reason they requested us to delete the two words. For the purposes of this statute, they have been deleted. They remain in the guidelines rules, but will be those rules will be considered when and if the Sentencing Guidelines Board has that extended authority to make those revisions.
Senator Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you mention that a sentence that was reached as a result of plea bargaining would not be appealable, the length of sentence?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, that's correct. That's in the situation as we were outlining that first, in the first section of the bill. Section 2 of the bill indicates that there is a process, and all the parties are well informed of the consequences. So if an offender agrees, it was determined that should not be subject later to appeal, just the sentencing issue.
You mean just the length of the sentence?
That's correct.
Just one second. And now I'm sorry. So there's a process that ensures that should not be a problem.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, because of the guidelines. Big issue had not been discussed.
We need to talk with Joseph and Crowd along with that too. We'll clarify, figure out some way to.
Moving on to Section 24, Amends ORS 144.040. This directs the board to determine whether an offender has violated the conditions of parole or post-prison supervision. Many of the sections in the next 20 or so sections broaden the board of parole's function to incorporate this new body of offenders who are under post-prison supervision. Section 25 amends ORS 144.050 to limit the application of parole function to those offenders who have sentenced outside of the guideline system or prior to the guideline system. Section 26 amends ORS 144.060. Once again, it reflects the change to the name of the parole board. It also includes post-prison supervision in the type of supervisory services provided by the Department of Corrections under contract or in contract with local governments. Section 27 amends ORS 144.075 to include transportation of post-prison supervision violators, as is now permitted for parole violators. Section 28 limits the statutory provisions related to the determination of parole release dates to those offenders sentenced under the current indeterminate sentencing system. These provisions include judicial mandatory minimum sentences. It does not, however, include ORS 144-260 or ORS 144-226 through 228. The 144-260 is notice of the offender's release, so offenders being released to post-prison supervision, the same notice that's now provided by the parole board to the local jurisdictions will still be provided for offenders under the post-prison supervision function. Also, the sections 144.226 and 228 relate to the consideration of dangerous offenders, and we will address those issues later in this document. Section 29 amends ORS 144.260 to expand the notice of release. Once again, this is where offenders or victims and other parties, I believe it's law enforcement officials, are notified of a release from an offender from prison. This would just extend it to those people who are released on post-prison supervision status. Section 30 begins those provisions that relate to the release of post-prison supervision offenders or offender sentenced under the guideline systems. This will be the case through sections 31 through 36. Section 31 limits the application of sections 32 to those 32 through 36 to offenders who are sentenced under the guideline system. And these are also a codification of rules that are now included in the guidelines rules of the Sentencing Guidelines Board for how offenders are released back into the community. First, section 32, it outlines the requirement that the Department of Corrections develop and implement a release plan for each offender being released to post-prison supervision. The board is directed to present the release plan, the Department of Corrections will prepare the release plan, present it to the board for approval within 60 days of the offender's release. So the parole board will be reviewing these release plans to determine if they feel it is adequate. The content of the release plan shall be as follows: a description of the support services and programs available to the offender, any proposed conditions of supervision, the proposed level of supervision, and any other public safety-oriented conditions that may be involved in the release of the offender. If the board rejects the plan after its review, it will be returned to the department. The department will then revise the plan and return to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision within 10 days. The board will then review the revised plan. If it still does not meet the board's standards, the board will implement its own plan and direct the department to carry it out. Section 33 just clarifies that the Department of Correction will still be responsible for supervision of those offenders who are released on post-prison supervision status. Section 34, this indicates that the supervisory authority will have the authority to adjust the level of supervision. The department now has a classification scheme for supervisory level for offenders released to parole. It is envisioned that this same type of instrument will be used to set the level of supervision for offenders being released on post-prison supervision. This section will allow them to adjust that level as necessary or as is appropriate during the term of supervision. Section 35 provides that the supervisory authority is directed to use a sanctions continuum. We will address an amendment at a later date that will allow for the current use of the Parole Violators Project, but we'll discuss that later in more detail later. Section 36 directs or gives the authority to the supervisory authority to request that an offender is returned to prison for a post-prison supervision sanction. This request will be made to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, which shall hold a revocation hearing. If the board determines that the revocation is appropriate, it will be authorized to impose a prison term sanction consistent with the rules of the Sentencing Guidelines Board. The hearings process will be essentially as is currently used for the determination of a parole revocation. Any offender who is returned to prison under subsection 3 of the section will be required to serve the entire term of the sanction without credit for any time of earned credits that might be available or any opportunity for a transitional leave. So whatever sanction is imposed, they will serve the entire time in prison. Section 37, this provision includes offenders on post-prison supervision in the coverage of the State's Uniform Act for out-of-state supervision. This is in the case a transfer of offenders out of state, basically, and will make sure that those offenders are released to some other supervisory authority in a foreign jurisdiction. Section 38 directs the adoption of rules which would make parole sets for offenders sentenced on or after September 1, 1989, for crimes committed prior to September 1 as comparable as possible as presumptive sentences. This is a section that we will be including recommendations for to delete this section, because at first what we had intended with this provision is that everybody who was sentenced after September 1, 1989 would get approximately the same sentence. Our concern, however, is with this provision, initially we were thinking in terms of equity and making sure that we were trying to get as much of that offender population sentenced under this, a consistent system as possible. But after further review, we're concerned that this provision may provide the hook to allow for retroactive application of the guidelines, which the council and the board have already specifically rejected as their intent. So this section, there will be a recommendation that this section be repealed from the bill.
By retroactive, we're of course talking about the stock population, people who have already been sentenced to the custody of the corrections division prior to September 1, 1989.
Moving on to Section 39, this section amends the guidelines enabling legislation to require that the trial courts state on the record reasons for departure as required by the rules of the Sentencing Guidelines Board. The current statute requires that a written opinion be made. It was determined after input from the trial judges that this would be an unnecessary burden, and that the information that needs to be provided will be provided on the sentencing report form. It will also be easily put on the record by oral communication by the sentencing judge at the time of sentencing. Sections 40 through 47 relate to revocations of post-prison supervision revocations. As I indicated, primarily the process will be comparable to the review or revocation process now in place for parolees. Section 40 amends ORS 144.317 to provide indigent defense for offenders on post-prison supervision who are subject to a revocation hearings. This is consistent with current practice for parolees. Section 41 amends ORS 144.335 to provide judicial review of the board's action to revoke post-prison supervision status. It should be noted perhaps here that the Board of Parole has indicated that it may be possible that an administrative review within the board may reduce the number of appeals. So that is an option that we will be investigating with the Board of Parole to determine whether that would be appropriate for this system. Section 46 amends ORS 144.340 to provide the department and the governor with the authority to return an offender from out of state who has violated the conditions of post-prison supervision that were imposed here in Oregon. This once again is just a comparable provision. This just includes post-prison supervision's offenders in that the treatment of parolees. Section 43 amends ORS 144.349 to provide that the revocation process that is now in place for parolees does not apply to offenders on post-prison supervision who are not in custody in the state to which he or she has been released or in federal custody. And I must confess a little ignorance on this provision. This legislation only indicates that post-prison offenders will be treated comparably to parolees. I'm not clear as to how parolees are treated under this provision now, but there will be a similar treatment for post-prison supervision offenders. Section 44 amends ORS 144.350 to provide for the arrest and detention of offenders who are believed to have violated the conditions of post-prison supervision. Sections 45 and 46 amend 144.374 and 144.376 respectively to provide that out-of-state agents may be deputized to return offenders to Oregon for supervision violations, It also permits the department to contract with those states for sharing the cost of returning those offenders. Section 47 amends ORS 144.380 to provide that offenders on post-prison supervision are considered fugitives after suspension of community supervision status. Once again, this is comparable to how parolees are treated. The next sections of the bill relate to offenders who are found guilty except for insane. Section 48 amends ORS 161.327. This clarifies that an offender who has been found guilty except for insanity is placed under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Review Board, Security Review Board, for a term that is up to or equal the statutory maximum sentence. It was the language that's included here in the bill is only intended to clarify that it's the statutory 5, 10, or 20-year sentence that is the sentence imposed or the jurisdiction that's imposed, not the presumptive presumptive sentence under the guidelines. Moving to misdemeanor sentences, Section 49, this provision authorizes the State Sentencing Guidelines Board to set by rule the maximum sentence for misdemeanor offenses committed on or after September 1, 1989. It also provides that revocation sanctions for those types of offenders would also be under the rules of the Sentencing Guidelines Board. If you will recall in our presentation, we have structured felony guidelines to be specific throughout the full range of felony offenses. Our concern is that we wish to make sanctions for misdemeanors as consistent as possible with the sanctions that we have created for felony offenders. This rule will allow us to do that on a temporary basis pending the development of misdemeanor guidelines, full misdemeanor guidelines by the Sentencing Guidelines Board, which would be presented to you during your 1991 session. Once again, this language specifically requires the board to develop sentences that are consistent with the policies that the legislature laid out in the enabling legislation that created the guidelines process in 1987. It should be noted that two types of offenses were excluded. One is a ORS 813.010, that's driving under the influence. The other is that would continue on the current provisions that apply to that offense, which I believe is a Class A misdemeanor. It also does not, there would not be a provision that would allow for any limitations on the probationary sentence that could be imposed for misdemeanor sex offenders. We had testimony that indicated that these offenders do require a significant amount of probationary supervision and that the current provisions in statute are adequate and appropriate for those types of offenders. Moving to Section 50, this section amends ORS 161.585 to limit its application to offenders sentenced for an offense committed prior to September 1, 1989. The statute allows certain felony convictions to be classified as misdemeanors under specified conditions according to the sentence imposed. For certain offenses, the sentence rather than actual judgment is what's determining whether the offense will be treated as a misdemeanor or a felony. The committee should be aware that ORS 161.705.
I've gotten lost in your.
Okay.
Direct us to the piece where you are now in the piece of legislation.
We're in Section 50, and it amends ORS 161.585.
Madam Chair.
Chair.
This is when we went through the rules, I think this is a section the committee identified as something they might want to look closely at. It's a fairly, at least arguably, according to some folks, and some folks disagree, but it's a fairly large change in the law in the way that it treats a number of often Class C felonies as well as B felony of possession over an ounce of marijuana. So I just wanted to flag that for the committee so we don't just since we're going kind of rapidly, so we're going to just skip over it.
That's section, which one?
Section 50.
50, yeah, okay. Go ahead, Bob. Just needed to know where we were here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to note very quickly that this statute does not affect ORS 161.705, which does allow a sentencing judge to treat Class C felonies and certain Class A and B felonies as misdemeanors under certain circumstances.
Not A and B's.
Section 705. I believe that certain drug offenses are now captured under that provision.
I think there's a limit, a very specific B felony, and that's possession of over an ounce of marijuana. I don't think there are any A felonies that are included in that.
I will check that, counsel. Sections, the next section.
Does it pertain to what B felony?
Possession of over an ounce of marijuana.
Just to that?
I believe that's the only one.
Then it goes to what and? What are we doing with it at this moment?
The section that Mr. Durson was just addressing says that the court, if it's inclined to, can at the time of sentencing declare that crime or C felonies a misdemeanor. What we're doing here with section 50 is amending the law as to the operation of crimes being classified by the sentence they receive. Presently, if a C felony, and again, this is arguable because I know Judge Ellis at least disagrees with this, but if a C felony is sentenced as a misdemeanor, for instance, the person gets a year in county jail, then it's considered a misdemeanor. And that also applies to the B felony of possession of over an ounce of marijuana. What we're doing by this amendment is saying that that only applies to crimes committed prior September 1st, so we no longer have that automatic misdemeanor treatment. And when I say automatic, I guess I should throw in a caution because I think some judges intend for crimes to become misdemeanors upon the successful completion of probation. And if we adopt this as it's written, that no longer is possible. So the judge will no longer have the option of he'll either have the choice of treating it as a felony or a misdemeanor from the get-go rather than saying if this person successfully completes probation, then it automatically becomes a misdemeanor.
The council, the board in reviewing, or the council in reviewing this piece of legislation did consider those issues. It was concerned that the offender's criminal history record accurately reflect the offender's prior criminal conduct. And for that reason, it felt that the sentencing judge was in the best position to determine whether that criminal conduct should be treated as a felony or a misdemeanor, but that it should be done at the time of sentencing. So that's the rationale that was used. Moving to Section 53, this relates to escapes and unauthorized departures. Oh, I'm sorry, Section 51. I'm skipping myself. This relates to escapes and unauthorized departures. Section 51 amends ORS 162.135. It narrows the definition of escape to exclude failure to return to custody from temporary leave. There's been a great amount of concern as to an alarming escape rate in Oregon. In fact, the escape from maximum and medium security facilities is very low compared to other states. The walkaway rate, however, is very high. And the council determined or is recommending that there be a distinction between walkaways and escapes and that it be reflected in the criminal code. And this is the effort to do that. The walkaway situation would then be added to the definition of unauthorized departure. This section also adds certain specific custody violations by individuals under jurisdictions to the definition of escape. So offenders who are under the jurisdiction of the PSRB would also, if they escape from a a mental hospital would be defined as an escape rather than as an unauthorized leave. Section 52 amends ORS 162.175 to then expand the crime of unauthorized departure to reflect the changes made to the escape definition and the definition of unauthorized departure. The section, there needs to be a correction in section 52 that I did not find early enough to tell LC. And in line 10, let's see, is that correct? Well, now I'm a bit lost myself, but I will talk to LC and determine what the problem. Oh, I believe it's in line.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
It looks like the problem might be that unauthorized departure is not categorized while aiding an unauthorized departure is.
That is
that correct. What you're looking for?
That's correct. That's correct. Now I recall what I was thinking, and we will correct that. So either aiding or the actual unauthorized departure would be covered by the statute.
So they're both A misdemeanors? That's the intent?
I believe so, yes. Moving to Section 53, this amends ORS 421.005 to define the term discharge in the statute. This only broadens the definition to include anybody who is lawfully released rather than anybody released to parole. It would also include people released to post-prison supervision. The custody of inmates, Sections 56 and on relate to how offenders are going to be 54, I'm sorry, how offenders will be dealt with within the correction and within the prison system.
Okay.
First section.
Bob, where can you come to a sort of a stopping point since we're going to lose Senator Springer?
Madam Chair,
I want to go a lot much further without having the full benefit of the larger committee. So why don't you come to the?
This is a good place to stop. Actually.
Okay, at the end of where are you now?
At say section the end 54. Of section 50, the end of 53.
Yep. Because we're talking about departures, and then we're coming into a life sentence. Okay, yes.
If we could pick up with section
else,
54.
I don't mean to cut you off directly. I just wanted to sort of not start another area. Anything else before we...
No, that is good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
I look forward to working on
Friday.
Crafting some of these pieces. Yes, Friday we'll continue with this and the other bills. Thank you. We're adjourned.